All right. Remember when we last left our hero David, it was kind of in a low point. It was really a bummer. As he was there in Gath in front of the king there, and you know, King Achish, you know, it was one of those deals where his people are telling him, hey, you know, what are we doing having this guy here? And, oh, but here, you know, here's David, and, you know, he wants to hang out with us now, whatever. And David gets kind of panicky, whatever, because they start talking about, hey, man, he's the one that killed Goliath. He's the one that's slain his tens of thousands and all that. And he starts freaking out, and so he pretends to be crazy. He pretends to be a madman and starts drooling on himself and all of that. Just really a low point in David's life there. And now, you know, we're gonna see him kind of really on his way back up. He's gonna get it together right now. And I wonder if when he was walking away from that whole deal, if he was asking himself, what was I doing? What was I thinking? You ever do that? You ever do something really stupid? And you go away thinking, man, why did I do that? Why did I say that? And I've done that so many times, I've lost track. But anyway, like we said before, God doesn't hide the faults of the men and women that He uses. He lets us see the kind of people that He uses. And you know, in doing that, it's encouraging because then we know that we can be used. If He only used perfect people, then we'd all be out of luck, wouldn't we? It's like, nope. Yeah, because there aren't any perfect people. Okay, so chapter 2 now, in verse 1, he is just leaving the house of Achish there in Gath. And it says, David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. So he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. So he leaves Gath, travels east to Adullam, and his family and really a band of misfits join him. You know, it talks about these people that are in distress. Some of your Bibles may say in trouble. We're not really told what kind of trouble they were in, whether they were in trouble from friends, neighbors, relatives, or in trouble with the king, the government, and that kind of deal. We don't know. But they were in trouble of some kind. And those that were in debt were brought to him. So really nobody that could add to David, that nobody could really bless him there. You know, they were in debt. They couldn't say, hey, man, I got lots of money. I love you, man. I want to take care of you. I'll finance this military operation. I'll finance it, you know, you hiding out and all that kind of stuff. These guys that were in debt, they could not help David out at all. And then it says the discontented went with him. So David had his own Tea Party people, you know. Yeah, these guys, you know, they were discontented. We don't know what, probably from the way Saul was doing things, you know. So they joined David. And the word discontented in the Hebrew is literally bitter of soul. And when I was reading this, you know, I really saw that how it really isn't so much like the church. These guys, they're all of these misfits, all these guys in trouble and debt and discontented, they're bitter of soul, and they found hope in David. They say, you know, this guy can help. His hand is upon this guy, and David here really is a picture of Christ. And how, doesn't this kind of represent the church? I mean, Jesus himself being rejected by the rulers, rejected by those in charge, as David was. He's, you know, on the run right now from the king, from Saul. And he receives all these lost souls, all these people that are all messed up. And you know, they're in trouble. And just like us, we were all in trouble when we came to Christ, right? I mean, that's why we came to Christ, right? It was because we realized, I've sinned. I'm in trouble with God. We realized that I've sinned. I've fallen short of the glory of God. And the wages of sin is death. That I deserve to die. But then we found out that Jesus died in my place. Jesus died in your place. And that by trusting in what Christ did on the cross, by surrendering your life to Him, that He would receive you, just like David does here. And it's a great picture, you know. And in 1 Corinthians, we're given a picture of really what the church is all about. Sometimes there are those within the church, and they get a little sidetracked there and start thinking that, hey, God really chooses the cool people, and you even got, you know, a church down in Tucson called the Cool Church. That's what they call themselves. But when you get right down to who God calls and who God saves and who He uses, really, it's the humble. It's those people that realize, I ain't cool. I'm messed up, man. I got trouble. I'm in distress. I'm bitter of heart. I realize my bad condition. But in 1 Corinthians 1, starting in verse 26, Paul addressing the Corinthian church. Okay, so get this idea, okay? Let's say this is the church of Corinth right here. And you're sitting out there, you know, listening to the pastor read this letter from Paul that's addressed to you, okay? And this is Paul speaking to the Corinthian church. He says, "For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called." Now, understand what he's saying there, you know? Not many of you guys are wise, are you? Not many are noble. And then he says in verse 27, "But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. And the base things of the world and the things which are despised, God has chosen. And the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in His presence." See, that's what it's all about. Just like with these guys coming to David, no one could boast about what an awesome army they had, that they were this elite fighting force kind of thing. If there was going to be victory that was going to happen, it had to be from God. And the only way that things could get done and get done well and right and victoriously would be if God did it. And that's the way it is within the church. God uses goofballs like me. So that if, you know, if He's able to speak to somebody, nobody goes, "Oh, I know why my life is so right. Because I've listened to Pastor Tony for so long. And I've gotten everything right from him." See, nobody can say that ever. God uses somebody like me where He goes, "Nah, it ain't him, man. It ain't him. It's got to be God." And I'm fond of saying, because I really believe it, that God is bigger than my bonehead mistakes. That's the only way that God can use me. Because I know that He's bigger than my mistakes. And you know what? He's bigger than your bonehead mistakes. Understand that. That whatever God calls you to do, it doesn't matter how much of a misfit you think you are. It doesn't matter if you think that you could have been one of David's guys here, you know, in trouble, in debt, discontented, whatever, you know, all of these outcasts. The thing is, God can use you because He's bigger than all of that. He's bigger than whatever shortcomings we have. And so, you know, these guys, they're there, and if anything's going to happen good, it's got to be the Lord, because it ain't going to be these guys. They can't run their own lives, just like us. We realize, Lord, I can't do it. I need You. And so we came to Christ for that. Now, let's see here, verse 3. It says, "Then David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, 'Please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me.' So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Now the prophet Gad said to David, 'Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go to the land of Judah.' So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth." Now, last week you heard me say that David's dad was probably dead. I was wrong. I forgot about this passage, and I did not read ahead. You know, so the thing is, because David's brother was giving the orders at this point, David's dad was probably pretty old. And in the Jewish tradition, they didn't do inheritances and all that kind of stuff the way we do. We wait until we're dead and then Junior gets it all kind of thing. That's not the way they did it. They gave out the inheritance a little at a time, and they gave the responsibility of handling the estate a little at a time. So by this point, the oldest son was probably kind of running things, and dad was what you might call retired or whatever, but although not really totally, but he was pretty, you know, the older brother was running things. So here, David now goes to Moab, which is east of the Dead Sea, and then he ask for the king to allow his mom and dad to be able to stay there. You know, they're up in years and all that. And maybe they were going to stay with David's great grandmother Ruth's relatives. You ever think about that? Remember, Ruth was a Moabitess. She was David's great grandmother. And so it's real possible that, you know, they kind of knew people over there. And so, hey, you know, let my mom and dad stay here until I see what God's going to do. And when it talks about going to the stronghold, that's actually Masada. I think most of you are familiar with what Masada is, but it's down on the west coast of the Dead Sea, kind of about two-thirds of the way south there on the Dead Sea. And it's that big, about a 1,400-foot mountain, really, that just kind of pops out of the desert there, and it overlooks the Dead Sea. And that's where, really, what we know it most for is when Jerusalem was conquered in 70 A.D., there were almost 1,000 Jews that were the zealots. They were actually the ones that started the revolt against Rome. They fled to Masada and held off the Romans there for several years. So that's where David went to. And then in verse 6, it says, when Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah with his spear in his hand. Boy, the guy doesn't let go of that thing, does he? And all his servants standing about him. Then Saul said to his servants who stood about him, hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? All of you have conspired against me, and there is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is not one of you who is sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. Like, oh, poor Saul. Nobody's sorry for me. It's like, man, you know, if you weren't such a creep, maybe somebody would be sorry for you. But you look at this, and the guy's paranoid already. You know, Jonathan, his son, did not stir David up against him. We've seen that. David's not stirred up against him in any way, shape, or form. David's running from his life because Saul stirred up against David. It's because of his paranoia and his jealousy that he comes after David. You know, and this is the way it is, man. When you start getting all worried about, you know, somebody's taking what's yours and all that kind of stuff, you know, he's over here accusing his men of being sellouts, that they have been bribed in some way, and that's why they're holding back information from him. And you know, even if they knew, it's possible that they didn't tell Saul because they knew Saul was wrong in pursuing David. I mean, David had a great reputation, and the people really looked up to him and all that. But, you know, the thing is, you know, they probably didn't know because of the way Jonathan and David were being pretty careful about who was to see or whatever. And remember, Jonathan wouldn't even let his servant boy hear what him and David were talking about. So I don't think they knew, but Saul, you know, in his paranoia, he doesn't care. He thinks everybody's out to get him. Verse 9 says, then answered Doeg the Edomite, remember him, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. So the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests who were in Nob, and they all came to the king. And Saul said, hear now, son of Ahitub. He answered, here I am, my lord. Then Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day? You know, so Saul here is kind of mixing facts with his own imagination. You know, yeah, David went there. Yeah, Ahimelech gave him some bread and gave him a sword. But the whole conspiring thing and all that, he's not listening really, and even when Ahimelech answers him, as we're going to see, he's not really listening to what he's saying. He's already made up his mind. He's already decided, you know, you're guilty, I'm going to get you, I'm going to make an example of you, really, is what's going on here. And when you think about this, you know, Proverbs tells us, you know, to answer a matter is folly before you hear the whole thing. And Saul's already kind of answered the whole thing, you're guilty, and before he hears what's going on, and he's already made up his mind. And that. So verse 14, Ahimelech answered the king and said, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it from me. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any in the house of my father. For your servant knew nothing of all this, little or much." So Ahimelech here, he's telling Saul some of the unwanted truth. And when he says, "Did I then begin to inquire of God for him?" Some of the translations worded a lot better. And it's like, hey, this isn't the first time that I've sought God for David. And you didn't have a problem with it before, is really what he's saying. He says, this isn't the first time. This isn't nothing new. And nobody's ever made a big deal about it before. And he tells him there's nobody like David, man. He's faithful to you. He's done nothing wrong. Saul doesn't like that, and he doesn't hear it. And he's, like you said, he's not listening. And verse 16 says, "And the king said, 'You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house.' Then the king said to the guards who stood about him, 'Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell it to me.' But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. And the king said to Doeg, 'You turn and kill the priests.' So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck the priests and killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. Also Nob, the city of the priests, he struck with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and nursing infants, oxen and donkeys and sheep with the edge of the sword." Saul's guards, being Jews, being raised as Jews, really, I believe, had that sense of you don't mess with God's people. You don't mess with his priests. You don't mess with his servants, because you're messing with God at that point. And so it was like hands off for them. There's no way. They had that respect for the priests of the Lord. Doeg, the Edomite, didn't. Like we talked about last week, that he was an Edomite who converted to Judaism. And the thing is here, as a result of the way our society has been really teaching our young kids that there is no God, it's all about evolution, it's, you know, no God, and really, for the most part, most Christians have been silent for the last 20, 30, 40 years. Haven't really been standing up and saying, wait a minute, man, wait a minute. There is a God. And evolution is false. A lot of Christians have just kind of taken the position of, oh, well, whatever you want to believe. And have, some have even tried to merge evolution with creation and all that kind of stuff and try and harmonize or homogenize the Bible with evolution. And the thing is, we've got a whole society of Doegs, Edomites, that are growing up around us that have no respect for God or the things of God, for you know, the people of God, you know, the places where God is worshipped. There's no respect for that at all. I know when I was a kid growing up, man, you never heard of churches being messed with, you know? It just didn't happen. I mean, you know, you just, you know, man, I wouldn't even want to yell inside of a church kind of thing. God's there. He's going to get you, you know, if you mess up. But there's no respect for that anymore. And you think about all the churches that have been set on fire in Texas just recently. All of those church fires. They just, I don't know how many there, what, six or seven of them, whatever, that they've torched. And then you've got that shooting in Richmond, California, where those two teenage brothers, both of them were shot and almost killed. They both survived, but you know, they were shot. And then there's been this rash of break-ins at church. It seems like every other day you're seeing them on the news where they're breaking in and stealing stuff out of churches. You can Google that. Just say church break-in, whatever. And watch how many stories you find all around the country of people breaking into churches. There's no respect for the things of God anymore. We've got a kind of we're growing up a nation of doegs that have no problem with messing with the things of God. And, you know, the solution for that, really, is for us to do our job, what Jesus gave us to do, go into all the world and preach the gospel. That's how societies are changed, one heart at a time. As you and I take the gospel to the people that we interact with every day and share the gospel with them and watch God change their hearts. And then as that happens, every revival that has ever broken out in church history has happened that way. And then, yeah, there are those big, you know, meetings and revivals that will happen as a result of that. But it really happens as, you know, one heart is changed at a time by you and I going and sharing the gospel. It really, the way that the world is going right now is really a sad testimony on the ineffectiveness of individual Christians in going out and doing what we're supposed to do in preaching the gospel. We got to get busy, folks. The time is short. Now, verse 20 says, now, one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priests. So David said to Abiathar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. Remember, we talked a little bit about that last week, in that David here now he's accepting the responsibility due to his running in fear and his lying to Ahimelech and all that. He put Ahimelech and all of his family in jeopardy and ended up costing them their lives. In verse 23, David says to Ahimelech, stay with me. Do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, but with me you shall be safe. And this kind of says a couple things. Number one, and you know, yeah, David accepts the responsibility. But also what this says is that David realizes, hey, God's hand is upon me. He's going to protect me. And the same God that's after you is after me. So hang with me. And that protection that God has over me, that's going to kind of wash off on you. You're going to be under that umbrella of protection. You with me. So then we get to chapter 23. It says, then they told David, saying, look, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah, and they are robbing the threshing floors. Therefore, David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go and attack these Philistines? And the Lord said to David, go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah. But David's men said to him, look, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines? Then David inquired of the Lord once again. And the Lord answered him and said, arise, go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines into your hand. And David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines, struck them with a mighty blow, and took away their livestock. So David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. The fact that David inquired of the Lord about going shows really that he is a man after God's own heart. I mean, there'd be some people that would say there, hey man, you know, and I'm sure his men were thinking this. Hey, it's not our place, man. It's not our job. Let the king handle that. I mean, these Philistines, they're bad dudes, and you know, we're on the run already. It's bad enough. We're real, you know, real living on the edge right now, man. We're real close to extinction ourselves. He assaults after us, man. And let's just hang out here. But David has that heart of God. He cares about what God cares about. He cares about God's people. And he cares enough to say, you know what, I think maybe I ought to do something about this. And so he goes and he seeks after the Lord and says, you know, should I go do something about this? You know, and his men probably did think, man, hey, you know, let's all take care of it. That's his deal. It's not our job. And it's really, again, this really should speak to us today. Because today we're told over and over again, hey, man, you shouldn't get involved. You know, if there's something going on, if there's somebody being attacked, somebody getting hurt, hey, don't do anything, man. Just let the police handle it. You know, just maybe, you know, if you want to, make a call, but, you know, don't let anybody see you make a call kind of deal, because you might get reprisals, you know, from that. You know, there might be reprisals on that. And I was just talking with Steve about this, that how just some of this stuff really just makes my blood boil. Because you guys have seen in the news how, was it like last week this time? I think it was last, actually exactly a week ago. That 15-year-old girl in a Seattle subway got really beat up bad and then kicked in the head while three of the subway security guards stood there and watched and didn't do a doggone thing. I mean, they're standing there with their bright chartreuse vests, and this 15-year-old girl was chased by these people from a department store, and she tried to get some police or the department store security guards to give her an escort to the bus bench or to the subway, and they wouldn't do it. And so these people that were after her came after her, and they wanted her stuff. They say, "Hey, man, you get some nice stuff." And she runs down, and you can watch the video. She runs and puts herself right in the middle of these three security guards, thinking, surely I'll be safe here. But, see, they're not supposed to get involved. They were just supposed to observe and report. And they allowed this girl to get yanked from them and just pummeled, you know, beat up out in the subway street thing here, and then back up onto the curb kind of deal. And then the gal, this other gal that attacked her, just stood over and kicked her in the head. I mean, a number of times. And these guys are just, you know, they don't do anything. You know, one guy calls and the other two are just kind of standing there, and they call the police. And it just bothers me. Or even you guys have all heard about the Alabama professor, that University of Alabama professor, Amy Bishop. Something that you might not have heard. When they were in that room, her and her co-workers, I guess it was the board letting her know your tenure has been denied and all that. When they told her, "You're not to be working here anymore," she pulls out a gun and she shoots six of her colleagues there. Three of them died, and then the gun jammed or something. That's what they said, that the gun jammed. And then the rest of them that hadn't been shot, they get up out of their chairs. They subdue her. Now, you expect me to say, and they held her on the ground, somebody called the police, and they held her until the police got there, right? Wrong. It says, the stories that I read, that they pushed her out of the room, closed the door behind her, and then barricaded the door. In other words, as long as we're safe, it's cool, it's somebody else's problem. And when I read that, I was worked up. And that kind of stuff really bothers me. Because, you know, James tells us, in James 4:17, it says, "Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin." If there's somebody that's being hurt, if there's somebody that you can help, and you don't do it, you look the other way, God says, to you that's sin. You know you should help. And yeah, it may be risky. You may get hurt. You may even get killed. You know, but what's your life worth if you have to live like a weasel? That's the way I look at it. You know, these guys, these security guards, they may have lost their job. Yeah, okay, so what? I'd rather be unemployed and be able to hold my head up and say, you know what, I did what was right, rather than have to live like a coward like that. And, you know, that kind of stuff, it bothers me. But, you know, David wasn't like that. He saw that there were these people in need, and he went there. You know, he inquired to the Lord, "Lord, should I do this?" But David's heart was moved to do that. And his men and David, they put their lives on the line to do what was right, to go and to come to the aid of God's people. And God gave them victory. And I think that God would give us victory if we would just step out and say, "God, I can't let this happen. I'm going to trust you. Just help me." And I believe God will meet us there. I know God has met me in a number of situations. You know, I'm still standing here, really, because of God. But it's just, to me, it's a real sad thing. And I growing up, man, I never, ever heard of this kind of stuff. But you hear about it all the time now. In verse 6, it says, "And he said to his men," I'm sorry, I'm one chapter over. In verse 6, it says, "Now it happened when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David at Keilah, that he went down with an ephod in his hand. In other words, all this is just kind of a reference to let you know this is how David sought the Lord. That here, this priest had actually brought one of the ephods so that he would be able to discern the Lord's will. And in verse 7, it says, "And Saul was told that David had gone to Keilah. So Saul said, 'God has delivered him into my hand, for he has shut himself in by entering a town that has gates and bars.' Then Saul called all the people together for war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. When David knew that Saul plotted evil against him, he said to Abiathar the priest, 'Bring the ephod here.' Then David said, 'O Lord God of Israel, your servant has certainly heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. Will the men of Keilah deliver me into his hand? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell your servant.' And the Lord said, 'He will come down.' Then David said, 'Will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul?' And the Lord said, 'They will deliver you.' So David and his men, about 600, arose and departed from Keilah and went wherever they could go. Then it was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, so he halted the expedition." What ingrates, huh? God said, "Yep, they'll deliver you." Even though David had come, risked his life, you know, didn't have to, but him and his men, they risked their lives to save the people of Keilah. They would go ahead and turn them over to Saul just to save their own necks. And what a drag, huh? That's kind of deal. But you know what? This really shows the character of David here. David could have hung around. He could have split at the last moment, you know, and he could have had Saul, you know, attack Keilah, whatever. But he didn't. He cares about what God cares about. And just like God is gracious to us, David here is kind of showing that example of being gracious. And, you know, he doesn't retaliate. He doesn't even, you know, spit on the leaders of Keilah as he leaves. He just takes off, him and his men. And it's like, look, let's just spare this city. Let's go on and maybe Saul won't attack this city. You know, and so he just continues to do the right thing here. It's just really neat. And, you know, it's in those tough times that our character is revealed. Anybody can look like a good guy when the going is easy, right? And it's real easy to be good when it's, you know, when it's all smooth sailing. But when you face things like this, that's when your character really shows. In James chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, it says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience." When our faith is tested, you know, it's when we think of a test, it's so that, you know, we can, that somebody can know. Like if you go to school, you take a test, it's so the teacher can know, are you soaking any of this up? Are you learning anything? How are you progressing? But not so with God and His tests. God's testing us isn't so that He can know what's going on inside of us. It's so we can know. God already knows. But see, it's when He turns up the heat, that's when the junk comes up to the top. That's when our character is shown, and that's when we go, ooh. You know, but in David's case, hey, he did good. God allowed him to be tested here, but, you know, he just does the right thing. In Romans 5, verses 3 and 4, it says, "And not only that, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance, character, and character, hope." See, God was preparing David for the ruling that he was going to be doing in his kingdom. And all of this stuff that he's going through, he comes and helps these people, and then finds out they're going to turn on you. You got to take off. You got to run. You got to go wherever you can. You know, it continues to show his character there, but God is building patience. He's building endurance. He's building, even deepening, David's character so that when David does come into office, then David's going to be a king after God's own heart. He's going to be able to rule well. Also, something you notice there, that he's now up to 600 men. He's been kind of picking up guys along the way here. And so he went from 400 to 600. And, you know, God's blessing him. He's a little bit bigger gang now. In verse 14, it says, "And David stayed in strongholds in the wilderness and remained in the mountains in the wilderness of Ziph. Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. So David saw that Saul had come out to seek his life. And David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a forest. Then Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the woods and strengthened his hand in God. And he said to him, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that." So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed in the woods, and Jonathan went to his own house. What an awesome friend, huh? There is just comforting David, and that's a true friend, because he risked his life to encourage David, to strengthen him. We already saw, we just read this last chapter, that Saul, as he is whining, was actually accusing his son Jonathan of being the one that instigated David. So Jonathan goes and he risks his life some more to go and encourage his buddy David and to say, "Hey, man, when you're king, I'm going to be right there at your side, man. I'm going to be there with you, man. I'm going to be one of the guys. You'll be next to you." And, you know, Saul pointed out to Jonathan, remember we saw that last week, "Hey, man, you ought to be the one upset because, you know, if it wasn't for David, you'd be the next king." But Jonathan isn't that kind of a guy. He's just he's got a great character there. Then in verse 19, it says, "Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, 'Is David not hiding with us in strongholds, in the woods, in the hill of Hakilah, which is on the south of Jeshimon? Now therefore, O king, come down according to all the desire of your soul to come down, and our part shall be to deliver him into the king's hand. Please go and find out for sure and see the place where his hideout is and who has seen him there, for I am told he is very crafty.'" I'm sorry, I skipped verse 21, didn't I? "And Saul said, 'Blessed are you of the Lord, for you have compassion on me.'" And he says, go find him out. Hey, he's pretty crafty. Verse 23 says, "See therefore and take knowledge of all the lurking places," I like that, "the lurking places where he hides, "and come back to me with certainty, and I will go with you, and it shall be, if he is in the land, that I will search for him throughout all the clans of Judah." Saul really, he gets this information from these Ziphites, and he says, "Well, go and make sure, and find out exactly where he's at, and then come back and tell me, and then I'll go out, and then I'll find him." Basically, what he wants is he wants a slam dunk here. He wants them to go and do the hard work, find him, come and tell me, then I'll go ahead and I'll find him and I'll take care of him. You know, and then in verse 24, it says, "So they arose and went to Ziph before Saul, but David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon, in the plain on the south of Jeshimon." So David is actually now 15 to 20 miles southeast of where they were looking for him. So they go, "Hey, you know, he's over in Ziph," and then David leaves, you know, in the meantime, whatever. So by the time they get back there to the wilderness of Ziph, he's already gone. He's not where they were looking for him at. Then verse 25 says, "When Saul and his men went to seek him, they told David. Therefore, he went down to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued David in the wilderness of Maon. Then Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. So David made haste to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were encircling David and his men to take them." What a great movie that would make, huh? I mean, all of this drama that we've seen, all of this intrigue. I mean, everybody's got their spies. Saul's got spies. David's got spies. Everybody's telling this guy that, "Hey, man, Saul's on his way. Hey, David's over here." Hey, and they're coming back and forth. They're getting all this intel back and forth. And Saul now has chased David, and David's on one side of the mountain. Saul's on the other side of the mountain. And now Saul's got his troops going around both sides of the mountain to encircle him and catch him. But David takes off, and God's protecting him. And this would make just a great movie, man. Somebody got to do that and really get the feel of what God is trying to show us here. Of how, imagine, think about being David and one of his men. How intense this must have been, this period of their life. And man, you're running all the time. You're a fugitive. You're on the run, and you know things are getting really close. You're risking your life over here saving your neighbors, and then all of a sudden the king's after you again. You know, and you're just one step away, man, from getting killed. In verse 27, it says, "But a messenger came to Saul, saying, 'Hurry and come, for the Philistines have invaded the land.' Therefore Saul returned from pursuing David and went against the Philistines. So they called that place the Rock of Escape. Then David went up from there and dwelt in strongholds at En-Gedi." Isn't it the truth that when we're busy fighting each other, the enemy knows about it and he takes advantage of it? Isn't that true, man? You know, it's been said before that Christians are one of the only armies that shoot their wounded. You know, that when a brother or sister is struggling, whatever, that, you know, we just kind of, that's it, man. You know, and then we'll say things and do things to further hurt that person rather than saying, "Hey, come on, let me help," kind of thing. Or, you know, that we get so busy in infighting. We want to argue. I just got an email from somebody, and they were talking about these friends of theirs that they were kind of debating with, and they got onto a topic, and they were debating this topic, and it got to be so upsetting that they said, "You know what, we need to stop, and we need to just pray for a while and seek the Lord on this." And the other side said, "No, we got to settle this. We are, you know," and then, man, they wanted to just keep going at it, kind of thing. And in 1 Peter 5, verse 8, it says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." I mean, there's nothing wrong with healthy debate, but we shouldn't be shooting each other down. We shouldn't, because somebody, you know, has a different outlook on a peripheral issue, we shouldn't be treating that person like they're not a brother or a sister. We should be seeking to build one another up, praying for one another, being there for one another, rather than, you know, just considering, "Well, you're the enemy." And I've seen pastors do that. I've heard of pastors doing that, talking about some other pastor or some other church. "They're the enemy." And just, it's sad. It's sad when that happens. And chapter 24, real quick. "Now, it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, 'Take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi.' Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men." Chosen men, folks, this is the elite guys, "from all Israel, and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. So he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave." Yeah, it's exactly what it sounds like. Saul has to relieve himself. He's got to go to the bathroom. So he just so happens to find this cave, and he goes into it. And now, you know, David, I'm sure, he's got men, and they were kind of hiding out about the cave, and, you know, that would have been standard procedure there. And, you know, they say, "Hey, man, he's coming up here." So they tuck back, and they go back into the back part of the cave. It was probably a huge cave. I don't know if all 600 people were there, but maybe they were. I mean, I've seen some pretty huge caves. I've been into some pretty huge caves before where you could fit 600 people in them pretty easy. And so he goes back in there, and they move back, and he goes in there, and he's using the bathroom there. And, you know, on one hand, it's a hilarious situation here, you know, reading it. On the other hand, I'm sure it's pretty intense again, you know. And all of David's men, "Man, now's your chance, man. Yeah." Look at verse 4. It says, "Then the men of David said to him, 'This is the day of which the Lord said to you, Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.' And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe." Can you imagine his men? David's men, "His robe, no, his throat, man, his throat, cut his throat, and we don't have to live like outcasts anymore. We don't have to be fugitives. Cut his throat, not the robe. Are you kidding?" But like we were talking about Sunday, remember when we were looking at Mark 8, and we looked at verse 33, where Peter, you know, he's kind of back and forth, and then Jesus tells him, you know, "Hey, man, you're not mindful of the things of God." And we saw that like within Peter's case, that sometimes it's real hard to discern the will of God. Sometimes it's hard to discern, is this from God or is this from the other guy? And sometimes it's kind of hard. But see, David is mindful of the things of God. That's what he's got at his heart. And he understands, man, you don't belong killing God's king, man. You don't do that. David knew that it was wrong. Look at verse 5. Verse 5 says, now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. Well, what a sensitive conscience, huh? This is great, man. It wasn't like Saul, man, whose conscience was seared with a hot iron, like we're told in the New Testament. But verse 6 it says, and he said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way, folded up his newspaper and then, you know, left the cave. But, you know, David was a very sensitive, you know, guy to God's will. And this is just such an awesome thing that David did. He even felt guilty about cutting the robe. But, you know, it was a good thing that he did, because look what happens here in verse 8. It says, David also arose afterward, went out of the cave, and called out to Saul, hey, who's going to clean up this mess in my living room? No. I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself there. Yeah. He calls out to Saul, saying, my lord the king. And when Saul looked behind him, can you imagine Saul hearing somebody behind him? He's just went in there and done his thing, you know. And he goes out thinking, you know, nobody saw, or, you know, I just went in and did my thing. And he walks out, and then somebody yells, hey, Saul! You know, and David calls out. David calls out and yells at him. I lost my place here. Okay, my lord the king, verse 8, and when Saul looked behind him, David stooped down with his face to the earth and bowed down. What a humble thing, huh? David could have killed him, man, but David now is just bowing down and showing this guy respect because he is the king. Verse 9, and David said to Saul, why do you listen to the words of men who say, indeed, David seeks your harm? Look this day, your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you, but my eye spared you. And I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Moreover, my father, see? Yes, see the corner of your robe in my hand? For in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you. Know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand, and I have not sinned against you. Yet you hunt my life to take it. Let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A flea? Therefore, let the Lord be judge, and judge between you and me, and see and plead my case, and deliver me out of your hand. You know, he shows Saul that, look, man, I could have killed you. Here's a piece of your robe. Here's proof. You could have been not the corner of your robe, but I could have stuck my sword into your back, or I could have come over and cut your head off, and you would have known it, you know, until your head, you were looking at your body, you know, and there, but the deal is, he shows him that, look, man, I'm not what you're thinking. I'm not what these guys, I don't know who's telling you this. I could have killed you and I didn't. And then he calls on God to be the one to take the vengeance, to judge the situation and to take the vengeance. You know, again, he's got a heart after God. He's mindful of the things of God. He knows that vengeance is the Lord's and God will repay. That we're not to do that. We're not to take vengeance on ourselves. And he puts things into perspective here. A dead dog, a flea. That's me, man. You know, 600 of my misfits against 3,000 of your crack troops, of your chosen men. Come on. Come on, Saul. Think this through, you know. And then in verse 16, so it was when David had finished speaking these words to Saul that Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" Oh, please. And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. Then he said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you with evil. And you have shown this day how you have dealt well with me, for when the Lord delivered me into your hand, you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely? Therefore, may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now I know indeed that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Therefore, swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house." So David swore to Saul, and Saul went home. But David and his men went up to the stronghold. It's kind of a cool deal here when you think about it. David now, you know, he shows everybody. And think about this. Not only his men know that he could have killed him, but now by holding up this corner of the robe, Saul's men knew, hey, David could have killed our boss here. He could have killed the king, but he didn't. And now Saul admits the same thing. He admits that God had delivered him into David's hand, but David was more righteous than Saul. And man, that's an understatement, isn't it? and he did not take the vengeance on him. You know, it's awesome. Great things happen when you do what is right. God is there, and he's able to take care of you. And, you know, in this grace and the mercy that David showed his enemy, Saul, that it's another picture of Christ, isn't it? Of how that when we deserve death, Jesus gave his life. You know, when he was being crucified, the Bible tells us that he could have called down legions of angels to come down and wipe out the enemies that were putting him on the cross, deliver him, and really wipe everybody out. But that would have meant our eternal damnation. It would have meant there would be no hope for us. There would be no salvation. But Jesus showed his love and his grace for us. And just like David, you know, he didn't do what he could have done. You know, he had held back. And, you know, now David gets a bit of a reprieve. Not much. It doesn't last long. Cycle Saul will be at it again. But we'll see that at another time. Let's stand up and pray.